Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. I'm Chet Haas from the UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And I'm Ficus Kirkpatrick, formerly of the Android team.
And returning guest.
Ex-Ficus, returning guest last time you joined us, I don't know, a couple of years ago, maybe? Have we been going that long?
It was one of the early episodes.
Yep. It was back when we had really horrible microphones. We talked about Volley. And we could talk about Volley again today, but that wasn't really the point of today's podcast. Volley is still there.
It's still there. You can still clone it, fork it, bash it, pop it, whatever you want.
Okay.
It still works.
Great. So Volley, part two. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll talk to you next week about nothing in particular. Ficus agreed to join us today for a departure from the norm. Normally, we talk about developer APIs like Volley and sort of the story behind them and mental models of how the stuff works and how to use it. Today, we thought it would be interesting to talk to someone that has been on Android since before the beginning to sort of get some picture of this thing that is called Android, where it came from, some of the people involved, and how we actually got to sort of here. And Ficus is one of those people, it turns out. You have been working on the Play Store, formerly Market, since I have been here.
Yeah, I joined the Android Market team. I've been kind of like floating around the Android team ever since the beginning, since before we came to Google.
Because of performance problems? Was this like teams pushing you off?
Basically, you know, I figure I stick around as long as I can on any particular project. And I had a pretty good run on Google Play and on Android Market. I think there was less attention paid to me than normal, which is why I was able to work on it for so long.
And finally, it caught up to you. Yeah.
I joined the Android Market team around the very, very end of 2009. So I pretty much started in earnest in 2010 and worked on it through to maybe a month ago when I moved on from the team.
And you were coding. So I joined sort of mid 2010, and you were on Market at that time. Obviously, you were coding at that time. You were then leading. Were you managing a team?
I don't remember exactly the time frame, but I joined the team just working on the client app, like the app that runs on your phone itself. Over time, kind of as the team people moved on, and you know teams changed shape over time, I took on more responsibility and. You know, by maybe 2012, I was managing the team, the client and server side of the team. And, you know, it's become quite a big product. You know, we have the developer console, the store app itself, all the recommendation systems. There's a bunch of payment stuff. It really has grown to be quite a thing.
It's also an ecosystem of lots of different pieces. I mean, the stuff that you mentioned, sort of back end and client stuff, but there's also the different content pieces. So when I joined, it was all about Market and there were apps on the store. And then in the next couple of years after that, we introduced Play Music and Play Movies and Books, and the content pieces came into the store.
Books was actually the first thing we added after apps. So Android Market made it to, it was Andy Rubin, who I'm sure we'll talk about a little later.
I've heard of him.
He's some guy. He wanted to kind of turn Android Market into this sort of destination where you could get all kinds of stuff, whether it's games or apps or, you know, anything you would use on your phone or tablet. Tablets were kind of just beginning to be born at that time. So then we went to this process of making it kind of multi-vertical, or we call them verticals. We ended up, you know, kind of rejiggering the infrastructure, and I helped with that a little bit, mostly on the client side in the beginning. I guess it was like 2012, we did the kind of big rebrand and sort of, as I put it, I'm sure a lot of people would be unhappy, put a coat of paint on it and called it Google Play. But it's still like kind of the code-wise was, you know, all the same infrastructure, same stuff underneath.
Now, why did we do Books first? Was that just easier to get the rights from the rights holders than, say, the music and movie licensing deals that had to be made?
Yeah, I mean, we had a collection of a lot of these things. Like, there was a music product like before Google Play or before that stuff, you know, where there's Google's been in, you know, some movie stuff with YouTube. It was more just about like what we were lighting up in the Play Store or Android Market product so that you could find it all in one place. In the very, very early days, we called this like the Universal Store project because we had all these different kind of stores that were spread out like on mobile websites. There wasn't really a native app, and we kind of like pulled it all into this one place.
So in the original Play Music for example, at that point, was it called Music? Like pre-Play Music, it was called something else, but there was a music app. Like how would you buy the content for it, or was it just uploaded content that you would...
Yeah, you couldn't really buy music. There was like there was a music app, which I actually worked on many, many years before I went to work on Android Market. But it was kind of like a prior pre-streaming generation sort of music app where, you know, you plug in your phone with USB and sideload MP3s onto it or what have you. So the team is working on that app and kind of working on some of the streaming service or the locker where, you know, Play Music, you can upload your own music to it, which I think is a feature that still nobody else really has. We integrated with them, and we kind of handled the store transactional side of being able to search and browse and buy stuff. But you know, there was a huge project. There were like all getting the deals with the record labels in order to be able to have the right to sell the stuff and get the payment stuff working and everything. And there's a lot of machinery behind the scenes.
Yeah, certainly. I remember the deals. I'm sure it's the same for everybody in the industry. Is sort of working with this industry that is way older and way slower moving and trying to get them into the digital frontier is kind of tricky. And, you know, all the labels have different elements to them and different legal requirements. And, you know, getting everything into one central place seems a bit tricky, which is why it probably took a while.
I think it's like the cost anybody pays when kind of things are undergoing some transformation. I think right now, I'm sure the partnerships people would roll their eyes at me for saying this, but I think it's easier now given that there's so much existing patterns of like streaming music services, you know, transactional, you know, music stores. They kind of can, they have a starting point at least on how to structure payments and like, you know, revenue sharing and all that stuff. But at the time, that was stuff that the partnerships team really had to go figure out and figure out if it was going to work from a business point of view. And
I guess now it's proven that, you know, consumers will pay for digital assets.
Whereas that wasn't always true for those of you grew up in a different era of the internet.
Fortunately, we've all been watching the warnings at the beginnings of our movies.
Yeah.
VHS
that have,
tapes.
That have, and our VHS.
I don't
want to
mess with the
tapes.
FBI. You know,
no, because it's, you know, it's illegal. So don't, just don't do it.
Don't copy that floppy.
So that was 2009, but you were on the Android team from the beginning. That was what, 2007, 2005?
2005, yeah.
Whoa. 2007 was what, that was the announcement or is that the acquisition?
2007, if I recall, was when Android started in 2004. I joined in 2005, pretty much just in time for Android to be acquired by Google. But Android joined Google in 2005, in July of 2005. 2007, I think, was the I think when we released the SDK.
Okay.
There was like an SDK release before we even had a device. It was kind of like a developer preview, which we're getting back into now. And then you know, from there we had the G1, right? It was the first the Android device. But you know, we were working on it for a couple of years before it was known at all to the public.
I remember I had friends on the team at that time, and I remember them not sleeping for a couple of years because there was so much to build. I mean, if you think about the infrastructure, what we have on these devices, basically you had early versions of everything, right? Whether it was, you know, the store, the OS, the kernel, the toolkit, the apps, all of that stuff to build all within a couple of years. It's pretty huge.
Yeah, we went through a fairly major reset, I want to say about 6 months in. After, you know, we came to Google, we hired some more people, you know, like the luminary, a lot of the luminaries of the team began to show up around that time. Like Diane Hackborn arrived, you know, not long after we came to Google. And we had like a fairly different tech stack and everything when we showed up at Google. And we, after a lot of kind of hemming and hawing and some heated debates, ended up essentially starting over in maybe 6 months in. And a lot of people don't know this, but our original kind of demo that we showed to Google was written in JavaScript before we came.
Did Google know that?
They loved it, actually. When Google bought the company, I had to interview at Google. Which is an interesting story in of itself. Google is very famously like staffed with these like genius computer scientists, right? You know, these like Stanford PhDs. And I did not attend college. And when Andy said, you know, oh, you know, the company's going to be bought by Google, I thought, wow, this is the only way I could ever possibly get in at Google. And they said, well, we have to go in an interview. And I thought, okay, well, that's it. It's over. Some of the interview questions I got were like, why would you do these native apps? It's like everything's obviously going to go to the web. Why don't you just make a browser that runs on this phone? And I, you know, I've been answering that question for 11 years since, you know, from a lot of people. But, you know, it, I think Google would have actually been pretty excited about JavaScript. We actually were too. It was mostly a decision of pragmatism. Another thing that's hard to think about in 2016 was that at the time to be on a phone and to get these carrier deals, you like had to have like support for J2ME.
Right.
So our original idea was that we were going to do everything in like a language independent way, and you're going to be able to write your apps in JavaScript, C++, or Java. At some point, we realized there's like 12 of us, and there's no way we were ever going to make that work. I don't remember exactly how many it was, but it was like a very, very small team at the time. And so we said, okay, well, we have to pick a language. And it didn't really feel like much of a choice, given that, you know, the carriers wanted to see support for J2ME apps and this kind of ecosystem that existed at the time. And, you know, some of us had had worked at Danger before on the Hip Top, or most people know as the Sidekick. And we kind of knew that we could make Java perform on a low-end device. So,
was that a J2ME device?
No, it wasn't J2ME, and in fact, it didn't even really run a JVM. But the apps were written in Java, and then the class files themselves were translated with a tool to like run on the same VM, which is a
familiar
concept, right?
Yeah.
So it was not this. It doesn't really resemble Dalvik. The machine, the virtual machine at Danger didn't really resemble Dalvik in any way. But that pattern of kind of programming in Java, which is a familiar language to developers, and then using a more efficient VM on the device was something that you know, we had done at Danger.
Right. So the web model though was also being tried. So WebOS at Palm, was that coincident with Android One? Sort of similar.
The exact time frame on that, but I know that it was around this. You know. From a decade on, you know, it was plus or minus a year or two. I know that they were working on that. Like Matthias Duarte, who came and worked on Android for a while, he was, I believe he was involved with that. And many of the people who eventually came to work on Android had also worked on WebOS. But I think it was around the same time. And I know that they had, I've heard pros and cons of WebOS from people who worked on it. And somebody said it was really tough to make it perform.
Right.
In some of these ways.
Which
but,
you would expect. I mean, it still is, right?
But I also heard it was just a dream from like a UI point of view, because the designers had all these like really mature tools or like building HTML stuff. And as engineers, there was like almost none of the UI engineering we end up having to do on Android now.
Yeah.
Because the designer could give you something and you like bind your data into it,
right.
and it was done. And
yeah, because that part of the stack was already finished, right?
Yeah, I'm very conflicted, because the developer half of me says, half of it says, well, I would hate JavaScript. I mean, I love statically typed languages. But on the other hand, CSS is quite a bit better for styling than what we have.
I agree.
So it would have been nice to have that. Dear framework team.
Yeah, we'll put that on the list. I mean,
we're entering the feature requests portion of the show today.
We usually have one of those, and in fact, they usually come from Tor. So I'll put that on the infinite list. That's an interesting model. Like, I assume that was a concrete decision in the past, not just like, I don't like CSS, but so many of the decisions on Android, especially early on, were driven by performance concerns. So yes, we have XML resource files, but really that's just a pre-processed thing. Like, it happens to be written in XML, but what it looks like on the other side, inside your APK, is nothing like XML. Right, all
is
of that.
That true? I thought it's essentially like a compact for like binary XML.
Well, okay,
right?
Okay, but yeah, it's not readable. Like you're basically looking at a bunch of, you know, ints, a bunch of really compressed data that it turns into. You can't take an XML file and sort of easily parse it through the same mechanisms that we're using.
Yeah,
for our research.
Basically structurally, it's the same. It's kind of the same thing,
right?
It's like open tag,
right,
open tag,
right.
Open tag, close
tag. Yeah,
That's for the XML source file. But I think that what it does is it just flattens the data structure. That is, it has the same header files on the device as an APT tool on the command line. It just takes that data structure and maps it over on the other side.
I see.
So it becomes just a binary blob of stuff.
Yep.
I think you still pull it out with a pull parser, but yep.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think someone, you know, like Diane is probably a better person to ask about some of this stuff, but you're right in that it's like very performance driven thing.
I mean, which is the right call, right? I mean, I don't think Android would have worked if they hadn't taken performance very, very seriously.
Yeah, there's so many things about the development of Android. This is like exactly why we're having this conversation today, I think, is there are so many things that were driven by the time that it came out and the constraints that we had, that if you had, you know, taken a long time to develop these architecturally pure APIs to develop, you know, patterns that, you know, high-level language programmers would love to use, you know, in these data structures that maybe are more readable and consumable and known to people.
And there's Enums.
Yeah.
We want to open that
all of that stuff,
oh,
right?
To talk about Enums.
So if... You
I
know,
actually say Enums. I don't know why I fell into it.
Okay, that's it. You're off the podcast. It's just Tor and I now. But if we had done that, like we could have done that, and A, it could have taken a very long time to actually come out with 1.0, and maybe 1.0 wouldn't have ever come out. I've been in companies where that's happened. And B, you would have come out with something that maybe wasn't performant enough, and therefore no developers would flock to it. It was the right combination of like good enough and fast enough for the devices at that time that allowed us to then build on top of it.
Yeah, like all engineering is just like dealing with constraints, right?
Yeah.
It's like all it is, and you're kind of – well, the thing that I think is kind of interesting, and I don't know if there's anything profound in this observation, is that you end up creating your own future constraints, right? These decisions that we made at the time, and they made sense given the situation we were in, now there are these things where there's been like huge amounts of knowledge and tooling built on top of the way the things work. And so it's just, again, the new constraint is, do we want to go like blow up this thing and totally redo the way content providers work? Like, probably not.
Right.
You know, because we did what we could with what we had at the time. And, you know, I think it's worked out well. I think you're absolutely right that, you know, you can try to design something perfect, and then while you're busy polishing it in the lab, somebody's going to come out with something and make you irrelevant. So I don't think anyone on the plenty of things that I think many people on the team throughout the whole history of the team, right, kind of like regret locally, you know, like, oh, I wish I could have like, you know, named that API something else or done something differently. But I think like on a macro scale, you know, it's hard to like decide what, you know, what's behind door number two, right? It clearly worked out pretty well.
Right. And you can't, like you said, you're designing your future constraints, because at no point in your future history can you ever say, well, now we're just going to come out with this, you know, V2 that's completely different. Because I've been in ecosystems where we attempted to do that, and basically nobody moves to V2 because V1 is good enough. They all know it. Everything is built on top of it. All the middleware stuff is built on top of it. And it's a huge shift to move to this other thing for incremental gains. So really, everything that you built back in the beginning is stuff that you are going to some extent, be stuck with forever, because that's where the inertia is.
Yeah. You know, I think it's easy to kind of look at one local area of something and say, oh, that's broken, or I want to change it, but not regard kind of the whole thing. I think the classic example of this is, you know, a new programming language. Somebody hates the syntax of some language or something, and they want to design a new language, and they forget that it's not as a matter of like making some new grammar and some new parser. There's like the debugger and the tools and all the questions on Stack Overflow about the existing language that is suboptimal in some way. I think it kind of gets a life of its own at some point. And like I said, it becomes the new world that you inhabit and the new constraints that you end up making your current trade-offs based on.
Yeah, from where I'm sitting, the tools part is a pretty big problem with a lot of new languages, right? You come up with some great language, but if the tool support isn't great, then who wants to use it?
Yeah, I think it's just a lot more – I think doing some of these things are a lot more expensive than people really give them credit for at first, for exactly the reason you're describing.
Also just the APIs, like when people are really just about their particular language du jour, the zealots come out and they're like, why can't we do this other thing? And part of the equation in my mind, at least with a lot of the language choices they may be making, is because the APIs won't work. You know, it's not just a language choice. It's about how do you actually deal with this, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of methods in this API service, this rich API service that we've developed for the last decade, right?
I think that said, the other side of my argument is like, I think if you adhered to my previous argument, like we would never have another programming language again, right? So it clearly needs to happen, and I don't claim to understand what it takes to get some new thing over the hump. But I think you can apply that pattern to many other systems, you know, APIs, you know, where you could, in theory, go and fix this one thing, but you start pulling on the thread and it.
But it seems like the ones that are successful often are successful because they're similar to what came before.
They're similar, right? Or there's also new domains. I think that's the push, is that like you're inventing a new thing, and therefore you can have a new paradigm and language and new class libraries and APIs around it.
I don't think Android would have been successful if it didn't come with like a new type of computer, right?
Right.
And same for iOS, for that matter, right? You know, I think like you know, many of these big changes in kind of systems, languages, and what have you are coincident with new hardware models, new form factors, things like that.
Yeah, because there's a motivation for developers to actually do something new to get on the new train, right? So you mentioned, switching gears a little bit, you mentioned some of the backstory sort of pre-Android. Can you give us a sense of like the companies or the background to before Android, right? So there are common groups of people, like some of the people that we still work with here came from, you mentioned Danger.
So many of the people on the Android team have known each other, worked together for, maybe 20 years. Android's, 10-something years old now, but there are kind of, it's a, you'd have to draw like a family tree, I think, of the various places, but there were a few congregations or moments in time. A lot of us worked at this company called B in the 90s that was doing an operating system, a case study in what we were just talking about. I think like it's really hard to just do a new operating system on the same kind of PCs. Windows and Mac were good enough in many ways. But we developed a lot of really pretty cool tech there. Diane Hackborn was there. Brian Swelland, who's like kind of one of the early systems kernel guys on Android. I was there. Hiroshi Lockheimer was there, and many other people. Around 2000, some of us went to this company, Danger, which I mentioned earlier. We did this thing we called the HipTop, but most people know as the Sidekick, as it was released by T-Mobile. And
HipTop, because that's where it sat on your body? What?
Yeah, I think it was like a joke on like a laptop. Versus, a hip top would be like something you hold on your hip, even though I would never be caught dead with one of those hip holsters for a phone. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That was, sure that we was can't just find like, any photos
my,
of that?
My Dockers pulled up to my belly button. no way.
I know what I'm photoshopping after this.
But many people, like those, some of those people who didn't come to Danger had went on to Palm, like Diane, and a lot of us sort of rejoined at Google to work on Android, about 10 or 11 years ago. And even, from B and from Danger, there were some other kind of, lineage. Like Andy Rubin was not from B. He had worked with at WebTV with some of their founders, and he had worked at Apple even before that. There's just, we kind of like found a group of people who, I think it's like eventually consistent. We're like all end up in the same place over time. And some of those teams were just phenomenal. The engineering team at B, at Danger. I didn't work at Palm, but just based on the people I know who came to Google and Android from Palm, phenomenal people like Dan Sandler. There were a lot of these things. Some of these technical ideas I mentioned, I think had some of their early primordial incarnations at these earlier places. Like at B, I remember multi-threaded programming was kind of like a not a typical thing you did and kind of
that was very early.
B was aggressively multi-processor, threading-based OS. And I think some of that stuff has persisted into Android. And
that was pre-like multi-core processors being the way, which came along maybe late 90s, that started getting more prevalent.
Weren't they showing off like multiple video streams sort of?
Yep.
Yeah.
I remember thinking at the time, so when B, Jean-Louis Gasset, right?
Old, yep, he was the CEO.
Apple, whatever he was doing at Apple, I can't remember. And I remember when it started, like I looked at the market, there was like PCs and then there was, the niche Mac market, and you couldn't imagine, it's like the political parties in the US, like you can't ever really imagine a third taking root because people don't have that much brain space, right? Like I can get the left and the right, but I can't get like something in the middle somewhere. And the OS is like, well, you have the dominant and then you have the subdominant, and why would there be another one? The interesting thing is years later, you sort of see, well, that company, that idea may not have succeeded, but maybe some of the technology ideas in it sort of came from that, somebody thinking a bit outside the box.
Yeah, I mean, I think like all systems are that way, right? Where you kind of stub your toe on a bunch of different stuff throughout your career and you you learn what feels promising and what doesn't. I think one thing that's interesting to say about kind of the technical cultural lineage of Android is that a lot of us came from these like embedded sort of systems. You think that B was this infamously, like I said, very aggressively multi-processor focused thing. These are like 133 megahertz processors and you have two of them, right? And or we did a Java-based user space at Danger, and our first device was like a 32 megahertz CPU and had like 8 megs of RAM. And so a lot of these things like enums and this philosophy of just extreme frugality in when it comes to CPU cycles or memory, I think that's an interesting lens to look at kind of a lot of the early Android decisions from, which is, you know, almost like I look at a lot of these engineers almost like as they were like raised during the Depression or something, and they learned to like scrape the bottom of the pot. And I mean, I think a lot of us came from that way, and to some degree, I still like kind of can't believe the modern shape of a lot of the, you know, these phones we have that have, you know, gigabytes of RAM and, you know.
Because but it's still the case that frugality, even though the phones today could operate super fast, right? You're still burning battery if you waste.
Yes.
Right. So there's still even you know, I think if you're doing server side computing, it doesn't matter. It's good enough. Right. But I think for
you, the spoken like a client engineer.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying like, you know,
I used to think that too. It's amazing how many power problems they actually have in these big data centers, which where it feels like the CPU and the RAM and the power is infinite.
It's not.
It's a different class of problem entirely, to be sure, when you have a battery. But I think it's also a trade-off, right? Like we could go and optimize everything to death and fit all this stuff in, you know, in smaller RAM, less CPU cycles, more battery, and we go work on it for 2 or 3 years, right? And I think that's a thing that is not often acknowledged, is that some of this stuff is just trade-offs to allow programmers to get stuff done faster, and ultimately, you know, you pay for it in RAM and CPU, and I think, like, on balance, like, I'd rather have the functionality and the features out there. And, you know, maybe we run out of runway on Moore's Law, which I think we are. But I think if you compare kind of the just net functionality of something you have in your hand now, even though there's so much more waste when it comes to, you know, what feels like is the right amount of memory to use for a problem if you're kind of like reared in this earlier era.
But we're right back to it, right? Because now we're dealing with watches. I'm holding my watch up. This is a podcast, so I have to explain what I'm doing.
Show that Tor is holding
yeah,
his wrist
right?
up.
So like now you're down to phone-sized devices again where the battery can't be bigger than a certain amount, and we have a lot of users who complain that they're too big, right? So now, again, we have to start counting our CPU cycles and worry about any kind of bloat that we can get rid of.
I'm not at all advocating the saying that profiling doesn't matter, that optimization doesn't matter. I just think there's a spectrum between being a complete hardliner about, you know, like, you know, this coming up with some, you know, arbitrary notion of how much, you know, memory or how many CPU cycles or, you know.
Yeah. I think
that's something should use, right?
To speak for Chet for a moment, since he's not here. Oh, wait. No, but, you know, I think the framework works very hard so that you don't have inefficiency in the framework, right? So you, app developer, you don't have to worry about it. You can use enums if you want. But the framework can't really sort of make those kinds of decisions, right? So I just found out about the incredible hoops Chet jumps through for animation to avoid object allocation. I thought he was using reflection. Turns out you're using JNI to handle object animators.
Turns out it doesn't allocate.
Yeah. So that's really, you know, it's one of those like really, really gross things, but it actually lets you animate without jank, which turns out to be a really, really good thing. Whereas I don't think we'd advocate any, you know, developers really do that in their own apps.
Right.
So, I think that's like more like you get enough leverage by doing that in the framework that it makes sense to do all the extra work, right? Because
right.
when you do that,
right.
you get it.
It know, multiplies.
Millions of apps yep. get to experience that. It may not make sense if you're one of those millions of apps, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. Like this is whenever we talk about this stuff externally, like, you know, then the enum thing comes up because it became sort of a religious war with some people. And we're like, you know, we can't use these things. I'm like, no. You need to understand why. And then you can make your own decision. I don't care whether you use them or not, but you need to understand why it can be a problem.
Yeah. I think I do think that the enum thing is a symbol,
yeah.
if you will, of that kind of like notion of frugality, right? Of
yeah.
like something that couldn't possibly matter. I think it does add up, right? I mean,
right.
all this stuff does add up. But anyway, I got off track a little bit. I think that I think it's important when you kind of, if you want to understand kind of why Android is the way it is from a technical, from a design level, like why the enum thing is a thing, is because a lot of the people who kind of made these early decisions really cut their teeth in a world where there just was not a lot of RAM, not a lot of CPU cycles, and we really did have to kind of like cut corners and wherever we could in order to make things even just fit, never
yep.
mind perform.
It seems like the watch actually came along a little bit late in our Android life, in that it's always, we can always build bigger, right? Like the, you know, a Gmail app now compared to a Gmail app on Android One, you know, vastly, vastly different. The amount of middleware in there, the amount of stuff going on, the services it's interacting with, all the stuff that it's doing because it can, right? So you develop this over time, and you know, that code base grows and grows and grows, and you know, allocates when it needs to and has the patterns that it needs to so that the engineers can be productive. And then they're told to make an app like that work on a watch. Like, going back to a limited device, that's way harder, right? Like, making this work in Android One on the limited G1 device was amazing. But when you're starting from scratch, you can make those trade-offs and constraints and develop around those constraints to hit that target. But once you've gone past that target and you have the APIs baked and you have the patterns baked and you have this growing code base, like, then how do you step back to more limited devices?
Well, it's kind of like now you remember coding on the Commodore 64 or Commodore Amiga or something, and you had so little RAM. And like, we spend more than the entire operating system on like the launcher icon asset.
Yeah.
You know, how did we do that?
Yeah. We were smarter then, I want to say. Yeah, I don't know.
Again,
progress.
It comes down to constraints, right? I think, like, if you juggling all these constraints, right? When you're looking at, you know, you have 32K or 64K of RAM to work with, that becomes the predominant constraint that you're thinking about. Whereas, you know, if you've got a gigabyte of RAM, but, you know, there's like a moral imperative to use as little of it as possible, it's just like not the reality of the thing you're going to be fighting against, right? Yeah. You're going to be thinking about something else. And I think that's just the nature of things.
There was an interesting dynamic that that was at Macromedia in the early days. I talked to Kevin, the CTO there, when I was at Adobe. He had been, you know, the CTO at Macromedia or whatever, and he'd said it at something I heard before I got to Adobe, that there was a memory budget you got for every feature you got to develop in Flash, because they were basically given this constraint by Netscape. If they wanted to bundle with Netscape, they had to be a certain size, you know, 150K plugin or something. And if you were given a feature for the next release of Flash, you were given a K budget and you had to hit that budget. Whether that meant that you were coming in under that budget for your feature, or whether you could find that amount of space somewhere else and carve it out.
Or get something else deleted.
Right.
Yeah. So WebTV, which is kind of one of the, you know, earlier sources, I think, on the lineage of Android, where, you know, Andy Rubin was there. Mm-hmm. I heard a lot of famous war stories from some of those guys. And at some point, they just ran out of space, like of storage space, and said, like, the OS image has gotten as big as it can possibly be. And they just simply had a rule that every change had to be net neutral or better,
yeah,
in terms of number of bytes. And yeah, there was just there was no other way around it. It was a physical constraint. I think it's great when you can kind of, Netscape could decide it's going to be 150K and that's it, but willpower is going to lose to physics every time, right? If, you know, you actually run out of space, that's what I mean by the kind of the predominant constraint of, like, if there's no,
right,
why is the RAM gone?
Right. Well, but I mean, that was sort of a physics constraint for Netscape, because that was like, that was their client. Like, if they didn't hit that hard constraint from Netscape, then they wouldn't be allowed in as a plugin. Therefore, that was a really hard limit that they had to hit. And it was a nice forcing function for them. But as you were talking before, like, moral imperatives are just not as much. Like, everybody knows that your app should be as small as possible, but if you're not given a really hard limit and a reason why, then you're not going to hit it as hard as, you know, Flash back in the early days or WebTV.
I think it's also, there's also a really hard trade-off to make here, which is, like, one thing we discussed a lot working on the Play Store was, you know, should we rank apps, you know, up if they're better battery users? They're, like, more frugal with battery and they're going to treat your battery better. And it turns out to be like a fairly hard problem, because there's no like correct amount of battery for an app to use. Like, if you're Strava, you're going to be like, have the GPS on and you're going to be sampling. And if you're, you know, a calculator, you're like a relatively static app and you're probably not using a lot of, you know, you're not waking up the GPU. Okay, that's not true. You probably are waking up the GPU, but it's not your own fault. You know what I'm saying, though? It's like I think trying to fit everyone into kind of like the same budget, like, actually cost, like, ends up harming one of the things that's coolest about computers in general, which is just like the possibility to, you know, use them to their full extent. I think you have the same problem if, you know, you want to design your code to run on some, you know, much smaller physical constraints phone, say, like, you know, an we could make everything run on the G1 now, but we would essentially be wasting all the resources that are available to us on a modern phone. And that's, I think, the trade-off you have to make all the time around, you know, getting to so many people who don't necessarily have the latest phone and don't have all the resources versus, like, actually making use of all the capabilities of the modern hardware. You know, I think, like, one-size-fits-all solutions just aren't going to work. And I think that maybe in super-constrained domains like a Netscape plugin, it's fine to say, okay, maybe, you know, you can be 150K maximum, but I think you'd lose something. You know, like, no video game could really, like, totally max out your computer or your phone if it was held to the same limit that you would decide a podcast player should have, right?
Right. So something like Pokemon Go, to take a relevant current example, like, I'm not actually a fan, but apparently a lot of people are. It takes advantage of a lot of things that modern devices can do, and it will suck your battery because it's doing so much. On the other hand, it's kind of cool that they're exploring a space and people are getting into this, you know, augmented reality stuff that is enabled by all the sensors and the visualization stuff. Right. So, yeah, if they said, well, you know, we can't use this stuff because it's going to eat the battery away, then maybe the users wouldn't even understand that you could do stuff like this on those devices. And then the users can make the call on that one. What you want to avoid is everybody turning on all of those bits all the time for no particular reason. Right.
I think my own opinion about this is the best you can do is try to be transparent and explain to the user. Right. Yeah. I think, like, stuff like showing where your battery is going is very good. Right. You know, so the user should be able to understand that. When you use Strava or you use Pokemon Go, it's just going to eat up a bunch of your battery. I actually don't think Strava's that bad. I should stop talking trash about them. I think the GPS stuff's actually quite efficient on the battery. But Pokemon Go is famously terrible. I'm actually going on a trip tomorrow for 2 weeks and bought a battery pack, and there was, like, a Pokemon Go ad on the battery pack. This is the battery pack for you to play Pokemon Go with.
I was a tourist in Japan recently, and I visited all these temples. And I guess that's where Pokemon places, important places to visit. So I was just surrounded by zombies who had their heads in their phones, not looking at the stuff, and I saw external battery packs hanging off the devices.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah.
No, but I think, like, you know, I don't think any one arbiter can decide that this is the right amount of RAM, this is the right amount of battery, this is the right amount of CPU. I think we get, like, the thing that's so cool about Android is that it gives people choice, right? You get choice of what kind of phone, what kind of watch, what kind of tablet you want to have. You get choice of a bunch of different apps, you know, And I think about that a lot, right? When you think, like, how do we decide where to set the constraints? You know, it's tough because every time you set a constraint, and I think this is stuff that, like, Diane has to agonize about when she's thinking about places to kind of make a wall or, you know, set like background check or something, right? You know, like, there's one point of view that says, oh, you know, if there's no background check, then, you know, developers can do whatever they want, and it's this glorious world, and they let 1,000 flowers bloom, but they bloom for 15 minutes and the device runs out of battery.
Well, I think that isn't that one of the things that they lock down a lot in N?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, is, like, Doze. And
right, and I think in N they turn off, you know, you have to actually change your apps if you're depending on being notified when certain things happen. I don't remember what.
Yeah, and they're going further in future releases background.
Basically, it's just not going to wake you up anymore.
For certain notifications, like for some of the media stuff.
Yep.
I think it's just, like, a philosophical point more than anything, right? Is, you know, I think wherever you want to make those constraints that make things healthier or more frugal, there's some outlier that you end up kind of constraining because of it, right?
Yep.
Let's dig into this story some more.
Yeah. So back before you joined Market, so there was acquisition. You joined, what, shortly before acquisition, and you started and then were part of the revamp where then it built around, what, Java programming language and needed the Dalvik runtime for that. Did that come from the startup, or was that also developed?
No, here? Dalvik, actually, I'm glad you asked this because I haven't got to say his name yet. Dan Bornstein was kind of the father of Dalvik, and that was done at Google. He came to Google after Android joined, but, you know, early enough that I think he's one of the people who really, really shaped the technical direction of Android by his, you know, kind of design and initial creation of Dalvik, which really set the runtime of Android on its course. I was a kernel engineer, so I was working on, you know, device drivers and board bring up and stuff like that, which is what I had been doing for a long time before. Even back at B, I did a lot of that, working on drivers. I worked really closely with Brian Sweland, who was kind of the kahuna of the systems world, kind of everything below user space, or maybe the lower levels of user space as well. And I kind of wandered around doing different projects before I came to Market. I ended up working on the camera driver for an early device, the Sooner, which I think is known publicly as the Sooner. I don't know.
I don't think
I'm giving up any major trade secret by talking about the Sooner.
It was going to come out sooner or later.
Okay. That'll be all. This interview is over. And from there, I ended up working on the media framework. So I worked on a lot of the original kind of like, video capture and audio playback kind of stuff. And then I got hornswoggled in like 2007 into working on the SMS app before the G1 launch. So I kind of had to learn Java for real. Actually, as a kernel engineer and as like a low-level framework engineer, I was mostly programming in C, C++, and sort of became an apps engineer. And that is what led me to working on the Market app itself around end of 2009.
Okay. So SMS, were you also working on some of, that's tied so intrinsically and horribly to like carrier standards as well as services like Google services around messaging?
None of the Google services side stuff. This was kind of a just straight up SMS app.
Okay.
We didn't have things like cloud backup of your messages at the time. There was a lot of carrier compliance certification stuff, which made me crazy, actually. The MMS standard in particular is really complex. There are all these things you can do with it, making slideshows and placing images, doing animations and playing sounds. And even though everyone knew that the only thing anyone ever actually wanted to do was send one and only one picture, you had to implement the whole thing because you'd have to go through carrier certification.
Is one of the requirements that that delivery of that one and only one picture you want to deliver be non-deterministic?
You'd think so.
I think that's part of the standard.
My other particular axe to grind on was that we had to implement read receipts. So if your phone receives a message, I have the option of saying, it's okay for you to, do a read receipt, or the sender can request a read receipt. Like, please tell me if this person received the message. But by the standard, you're not required to actually acknowledge receipt of the message. And my experience was the only
people. That was an easy feature to implement.
It's not, though, because the certification test harness checked it, even though no actual real device did. So we had to implement all this read receipt stuff, even though it was never actually used in the wild. That was like one of the reasons. It was a miracle I worked on that thing for a year, but.
It's like having to learn Esperanto to graduate from college.
Yeah.
No one else is going to speak it, but we need you to.
They used to have Latin, right? No offense to anyone who studies the classics.
In Rome, they did, certainly.
Yeah.
I think the SMS app was a pretty heavy user of the list view, right? So you must have had a lot of fun with that.
The thing that is burned into my memory was starting up, were a few things, all like performance things, basically. Like rotating the device, it would take 4 or 5 seconds when I started to do a screen rotation because it would tear down everything and it would uncreate your activity again. And so I must have spent like a month just optimizing uncreate in the main like conversation list activity of this thing. The other thing I remember was there was some code that detected classic style text emoticons and swapped them out for image resources. So if you had like, colon, parentheses, you'd get like a little yellow smiley face or something. In some other profiling session, I discovered that just doing this on one message was taking like 400 milliseconds or something, which is, it's SMS. It's like maxes out at like 160 characters, right? And it turned out it was some server-side code that like built a try in memory of all these things or whatever, and I replaced it with some disgusting regex, as many programmers have solved problems with throughout history.
Usually performance problems, but...
It went from...
It's usually on the other side of the performance fix, is what I mean.
It went from hundreds of milliseconds for message to one. So,
all right. Nice.
So this sounds like the first iteration of our emoji trials over time. So,
I'm sure that the actual native support for emojis that was done is... I've heard that it was, like, incredibly difficult.
It continues to be tiresome, I would say, just because the standard is constantly changing. And some of the changes are simply graphical assets, but you still have to get those assets out to the devices. Some of them are code changes, like now we're going to interpret, you know, assets in different ways to allow variations of
to
things.
To, like, combine them into a single glyph, yeah.
Right. And then, again, not only do you need to get those assets out to devices, but you need to get the code out to devices. Well, what if those devices are not updating? Like, how – it seems like an unsolvable problem where the standard is operating in a different dimension than the actual devices and platforms.
That's why I became a manager.
Just make it a web view.
Yes. What else?
I don't know. Did we cover all parts of – okay, so did that – and then you worked on the camera driver and SMS. Did that then take you up to market? So I guess, yeah.
Yeah, like I think working on the app side, you know, around 2009, I was looking for something new to do. And I had a few options to go work on the framework team. I thought about that. Honestly, a major factor in deciding not to go work on the core framework team was that I found that compiling and restarting the runtime all the time was just so horrible. I didn't want to do it every day. Chet knows.
Oh, it's gotten so much
better.
Better,
yeah.
Right.
Does
machines are faster.
Snod still exist?
Yep. Okay. I have a variation of that. Yep.
Like the last time I did that was probably 2008. And I thought, you know, I go work on Android Market, and I thought, this seems kind of a dumb project. Like, I was like, how hard is this? It's like a list view, and you tap on things, and you, like, download an APK file and give it to the package manager. Like, it's not that hard. I said, well, you know, but, like, I really like the manager, and I'll go work for her. She's really cool. We've worked together. So I'll just go do this for 6 months, and then I'll find something else to work on. And then I worked on it for, like, 6.5 years.
So of the original team, how big was the acquisition team? It was like eight people?
Eight people originally came to Google. There were four founders and three engineers and Andy's admin, Tracy, who is still here.
Okay, right. So I was going to ask, like, who is still left from that original team?
Many of them are still kicking around Google, or at least a few. So the four founders were Andy Rubin, who everybody knows, Nick Sears and Rich Miner, who are kind of on the business side of things. Yeah. They came from a carrier background. I think were really instrumental in us getting some of the early partnerships. This guy, Chris White, who left relatively early on, but he was kind of the engineering leader when we first got to Google. And then the three engineers were me, Brian Sweatland, and Andy McFadden.
Okay.
And Andy worked Andy McFadden, or Fadden as we all call him. He worked a lot on the runtime in the early days, but he did a bunch of stuff. He's an incredible programmer.
Yeah, he was still working on runtime when I got here. He was working on the Dalvik team.
And Tracy. So it was just eight of us, really. I think that the kind of original eight is a little overblown, to be honest. Diane was not one of the original eight, but I think she has, you know, as much, if not more, claim to kind of the shape of Android than any of me, certainly.
Certainly. I mean, there are different parts of Android that are more or less visible and working on framework APIs. Like, well, that's the surface that most developers are going to touch. So they're not necessarily going to see directly the stuff that Sweatland did on device bring up or system development stuff. He was doing really fundamental stuff, but like the touch point for developers is not quite as direct.
Yeah, I think from the outside, the person whose work is most, you know, defines most of the shape is clearly Diane. Like so much of the API design, I'm sure she would probably downplay her influence here, but she's wrong if she would say that. I think there was like three people who really made Android the shape it is at kind of a super macro level, which is her and Dan Bornstein with Dalvik.
Yep.
and Sweatland. Sweatland was actually the one who did that Java class files to other VM system back at Danger. So he, in many ways, I think, really influenced that, and he had handed it off to Dan at Danger, Dan Bornstein. So, but I think that, you know, the three of them really, you know, there's so many people who worked on Android over the years and who had, like, such a huge contribution, but those are the three that really loom large in my mind as the ones who kind of made the decisions that really made, kind of led Android to what it is today. There's a ton of other people I could mention. I'll mention Jeff Hamilton because I publicly identify him as the creator of Content Provider, which is like my least favorite Android. I love him actually.
And Google Play Services. He works on Google Play Services now, too. I think we interviewed him on the podcast.
We did. We talked about Play Services probably a couple of years ago, around the same time as we talked about Volley. And he is, I think he's the tallest Android engineer that I know.
I think he's about 9 foot 100, just based on from my stature.
In metric, anyway, yeah.
I interviewed Jeff Hamilton at Google, and the highest score I've ever given anyone on an interview. You know, nobody's perfect.
Nice. Well, moment of silence for Jeff Hamilton, then.
I agree.
And what about on the leadership side? Obviously, Andy, I don't know if you have... So you would have known him far better, obviously, since you came in with the company.
Most of the time I spent with Andy early on was that I had worked at Danger.
Yeah.
So he was one of the founders and the CEO of Danger, which I joined in the beginning of 2000. And he... I joined that company when we were all in one room, and it got up to a couple hundred people by the time I left 4 or so years later. There's a million stories about Andy, right? I mean, he's clearly a brilliant guy, and I think a lot of us still look up to him a lot. But I also feel like he's the one people know the most about, and maybe not all the stories are true, but they're maybe more fun than some of them are true.
Yeah, I think I just thought of him again because you had mentioned him earlier in sort of setting the direction. And you know, he, even though he wasn't doing coding here that I knew of when I joined, he certainly set technical visionary direction when he cared about something. It was something in play, the content being surfaced in play.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are so many things that I think were Andy's brain children. Not necessarily. Andy's like not like designing APIs, but I think what he cared about stuff like it's got to be fast.
Yep.
You know, I remember being beat up by Andy on, you know, this just isn't fast enough. And I'd be super tired and had been at work for however long and was really angry that I wasn't actually done yet. And, you know, once I got over a week later, I realized he was right. And I think he really pushed for things to be fast. And I think it was really from him that kind of Android took such a partnership-based approach. As compared to like the iPhone or something, right, which is kind of like Apple, you know, for better or worse, owns the ecosystem, and I think they're able to control a lot more things. And I think some of us in the Android team are jealous, like, oh, you know, like it'd be so easy for Apple to just decide this is going to be in next year's hardware, and they can do that. And I think that Andy really gets partnering with people and building ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the reason why there's this, you know, flourishing of so many different Android devices, and it just feels much more like a coalition to me. And I think that was a lot of what Andy did culturally, was this partnerships mentality.
Right, which has got to be one of the fundamental things that allowed the ecosystem to actually start.
I think in a nutshell, flourish. Like that's why Android works.
Yeah.
Right, is that it's, everyone's kind of in it together.
Yeah.
You know, which... Life's full of trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
You know, it has its pros and cons, but I think that we never would have like reached the scale and the success that Android had reached without that approach of, diversity and partnership.
All right, then.
That seems like a really good place to end.
I think we should probably call it then. Got anything else to add?
I'm sorry to anyone on the Android team who I failed to mention. There are so many people, but I did want to spend most of my time talking about people who I think got are not known as well publicly and give them a little shout out for their work. But
the Android team is pretty large now. I don't think we speak publicly about any numbers, but
it's a pretty massive effort at this point. It's been a long time, and there have been a lot of people who've come and gone. And I hope there's more of this recounting of the early years. I'm sure like my memory has been failing and gotten some of these details wrong, but it's just the coolest thing you could ever be part of, you know?
I agree. Thanks.
Thank you.